what is the nature of the native title claim in relation to the Adani mine?
Right. Well, as with most native title claims, the particulars of what's claimed is quite specific to the group of people. But this one includes, I think, a fairly broad spectrum of rights in relation to the land. So sometimes the rights that are claimed are, you know, a right to hold ceremonies on the land. Other times it's an entire right of exclusive use. But the problem that you have here in the contest between traditional owners and the miner is that pretty much any kind of right that's claimed is affected by mining, because mining, you know, destroys the land itself. Mm. One of the features of native title is that the common law, so that is our legal system, recognises the rights according to traditional law and custom. So the claimants need to show that under traditional law and custom, they have a particular set of rights over that land, and that's exactly what's happened here.
How is that process actually determined there? I mean, you kind of mentioned the sliding scale of rights you would have in that kind of area, but how are those rights actually determined?
So when a claim is lodged, and it's lodged initially through the National Native Title Tribunal and through the federal court, so there's a lot of processes that work together there, and the claim is made based on evidence. So in Queensland here, for example, we have a particular form of reports that you offer to the state to show that a connection report. You show that there is enough evidence to support these interests. And so in every native title claim involves traditional owners against the state government. That's just the way that native title has been set up under the legislation. So every time a claim is lodged, the state government is automatically in opposition to that claim, and the claimants have to prove that under laws that existed at the time of colonisation, that those interests in land have continued and haven't been interrupted by colonisation. So as you can imagine, that's really, really hard to do because obviously people's lives have been, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's lives have been massively affected by colonisation. And the kinds of evidence that they put to the court are generally, you know, anthropologists come in and explain how the laws have continued. You have, you know, the journals from the early explorers and early pastoralists and this sort of thing, and all of that is adduced to the court, as well as evidence from the claimant group themselves about the ongoing existence of those laws in relation to the land.
I mean, on the face of it, to me, it sounds virtually impossible. I can't imagine where you would even begin a process like that. So in terms of what the general Australian public who don't have this kind of legal expertise would think when they think of native title law, would it be fair to say we have not achieved the kind of balance of rights that would fulfil the aims and the expectations around native title law?
Yes, the Native Title Act certainly it has quite a long preamble. So those are sort of introductory words explaining the purpose of the legislation, and it says, you know, following the Mabo decision in 1992, the Native Title Act says, or it talks about, you know, international norms of human rights and justice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians. And then it implements this process that in reality is just so difficult for traditional owners to be able to satisfy these requirements. And I think that there's a couple of things we need to remember. One is that especially for those traditional owner groups who have been successful in their determinations and have had native title recognised on their land, this is still seen to be like a really important pillar of their lives. There's been a lot of struggle and they've been successful and they have access to their lands now. So I just want to acknowledge that the way that a lot of traditional owners have experienced this has turned out okay in the end, For other groups, it's really, really hard. And that is especially the case in areas that have that were colonised quite early. And so you saw this with the Yorta Yorta people down in Victoria, and their claim went all the way to the High Court, and it was overturned, and the court used words like, you know, the tide of history has washed away, you know, your traditional interest in this land, and that was just such a devastating example of the inconsistencies that we see and the different experiences that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have in relation to native title. We still have not achieved that basic justice, in my view.
I mean, it would seem to me that even in those positive examples there, it's very much at the behest of, you know, a decision maker determining these kinds of things rather than, you know, any sort of real sense of law or fairness in this. Were there any sort of proposed reforms that could help resolve some of the shortcomings of this native title system?
Look, there was a really comprehensive report put out in 2015 by the Australian Law Reform Commission and suggested a raft of amendments to native title law, but that hasn't ever been implemented. So that report is sort of still sitting there. And in the meantime, we've seen some what I would describe as ad hoc reforms. So, for example, a couple of years ago, there was a decision that was made, that was handed down, and it challenged the basis of decision-making amongst claimant groups. So what you have is a process through all native title determinations, and in the case of a situation like Adani, when you're looking at a land use agreement and you have the claimant group meets and negotiates with the person who wants to use the land, say the miner or whoever. And in those meetings, there's a whole lot of really formalistic types of requirements that are needed to be able to take those negotiations forward and to get the consent of the claimant group. And in this decision a couple of years ago, the court found that you literally needed the consent of everyone to be able to pass through these determination processes. And what that did was that put at stake all of the decisions that had already been put into place. If there were one or two people who had disagreed with stuff, then those decisions might be overturned or reviewed. And the government at the time said, you know, holy cow, we can't upset all of the, you know, the miners' processes, and we can't upset all of these existing determinations. And in fact, there were traditional owners too. You know, if they'd already had a determination, they didn't want to have that revisited. So there was quite a lot of uncertainty, and so a law was passed quite quickly to confirm what the situation would be. So we've seen those ad hoc sorts of reforms, but we haven't seen any sort of root and branch reform that might facilitate claimant groups in being able to advance their claims in a way that I think would be much more just for them. It's really sort of business efficacy, if you like, for, you know, miners and people like that who are seeking to negotiate.
Well, it's an immensely complex one. Kate, do appreciate you unpacking it for us a little bit this morning.
Cheers.